Today, we're going to be taking a look at the story of the deposition of Rabban Gamliel. As a reminder, we encountered Rabban Gamliel last time and the time before in the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the plastered cistern who gets kicked out of the Beit Midrash. Really excommunicated, I should say. Now, I want to remind us of two main things about Rabban Gamliel. The first is that Rabban Gamliel is the political head of the Jewish people at this time. He is the Nasi. And it seems that by the time we get to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's excommunication, it seems that Rabban Gamliel has also become head of the Beit Midrash. That's the first thing to remember. The second thing I want us to remember is the scene on the boat when, after Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's excommunication, Rabban Gamliel is traveling on a boat and a wave comes and seems like it's almost going to cause the boat to capsize. And what I want us to remember from that scene is specifically Rabban Gamliel's sort of plea to the wave and through it, obviously, to God, in which he says, "Know that I did this not for my own honor, nor for the honor of my father's house, but so that disputes should not multiply in Israel." Shelo yirbu machlokot b'Yisrael. And I want us to pay attention to that for a number of reasons. The first is, what's I think it reveals a lot about the animating fear, both behind Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's expulsion, but also that might pervade in the Beit Midrash at this time, that disputes should not multiply in Israel. What sort of a fear is that? That's a fear that says there are so few of us left. If we allow intra-Beit Midrash struggles to take place, differences of opinion, arguments, it might break up this very, very fragile sort of new world that we're trying to create. And Rabban Gamliel's answer to that is to try to use power and to try to use force in order to subdue dispute. I want also to remind us, in the generation that we're looking at, this makes a lot of sense. Well, one of the things that the rabbis think led to the downfall of the Jewish people before the destruction of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash was indeed these intra-Jewish struggles, intra-Jewish disputes. Rabban Gamliel is looking at that history and saying, not again. We cannot tolerate that at this point. We can understand the strategy and we can also understand the human cost that that comes with and ask ourselves, what sort of a Beit Midrash would that sort of a fear produce? The story we're going to look at today is going to be a story in which that fear, the fear of disputes multiplying in Israel, will come to a head and, I think, bring us into a sort of new chapter for this generation of the Beit Midrash that we've been looking at. Let's dive in and get started. Okay. Our two main characters today, as a reminder, will be Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua. I'll give you just a little bit of background about these two men that I think will be important. Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi, comes from incredible wealth, probably the most wealthy man of his generation, has inherited his position. Rabbi Yehoshua is very different. Rabbi Yehoshua is a blacksmith. He's working class. He does not come, it seems, from a particularly prominent family. He rises through his own sort of achievement. And although we won't have time to look at this together, he and Rabban Gamliel have had a number of run-ins in the past. If you want to take a look on the source sheet, which you can find in the folder, you'll see before where we're diving in today on the source sheet, a number of incidents of run-ins between Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabban Gamliel. At the moment where our story opens, these two men already have quite a history together, a history, I would say, both of respect and also wariness. Let's dive in. Our rabbis have talked. This is a story from the Babylonian Talmud, Masechet Brachot. It happened that a disciple came before Rabbi Yoshua. He said to him, "Is the evening service, arvit, voluntary or obligatory?" He said, "It is voluntary." He came before Rabbi Gamliel and asked him, "Is the evening service, arvit, voluntary or obligatory?" He said, "It is obligatory." Let's pause for a moment. We've talked about how the opening halachic question in a Talmudic story is often of importance itself. Here I want us to pay attention to the answer that Rabbi Yoshua and Rabban Gamliel each give. Rabbi Yoshua, by giving an answer that says voluntary, you can pray it or you cannot pray it, it's up to you, is giving an answer that allows for multiplicity of practice. In a story that is going to be about, can the Beit Midrash tolerate dispute? Can the Beit Midrash tolerate a number of different opinions? That's important. Rabban Gamliel, meanwhile, says, no, it's obligatory. Rabban Gamliel's answer does not allow for multiplicity of practice. He wants everyone doing the same thing. The disciple replied, but did Rabbi Yoshua not say it was voluntary? Why the disciple is doing this, by the way, saying to Rabban Gamliel, who we know does not like disputes in the Beit Midrash, oh, well, Rabbi Yoshua gave me a different answer, is a world of its own. Is this a disciple who's trying to get Rabbi Yoshua in trouble? Is this a disciple who's trying to stoke the fires in the Beit Midrash to bring everything to a head? We don't quite know. Rabban Gamliel said, wait until the shield bearers enter the Beit Midrash. Let's pay attention to this language, shield bearers. Shield bearers is a phrase that the Gemara will sometimes use for Talmidei Chachamim, for the rabbis of the Beit Midrash in different situations. I want to suggest that here its use is not coincidental. Rabban Gamliel is preparing us for what is about to happen, which he sees as a war. And shield bearers specifically as a defensive war. He sees a threat within the Beit Midrash and he is going to use whatever means he needs to shut down that threat. When the shield bearers entered, this questioner stood up and asked, is the evening service voluntary or obligatory? Rabban Gamliel said to him, obligatory. Rabban Gamliel said to the sages, is there anyone who has a different opinion on this matter? Rabbi Yoshua said to him, no. Let's just note this. The stories in the Talmud are very, I would say, sparse. They don't give us a lot of stage direction. But you can infer from the fact that Rabbi Yoshua specifically says no, that Rabban Gamliel might be looking at him specifically very pointedly at this moment. You almost imagine Rabban Gamliel's eyes getting wider and him putting his face in Rabbi Yoshua's face and saying, is there anyone who thinks differently about this? And Rabbi Yoshua is saying, no, no, everyone agrees. Rabban Gamliel said to him, was it not in your name that they told me it was optional? I want us to pay attention here. There's something interesting going on. If all that Rabban Gamliel cares about is uniformity of opinion, he should let this go once Rabbi Yoshua says, no, no, everyone agrees with you. Because that means that Rabbi Yoshua is willing to say, okay, you've made your point. You're in charge. I'll go along with your opinion. But I think a big part of what these stories do is show the very wavy line between where the ideological, the well-motivated meets human weaknesses, human frailty, human ego. If you have become so concerned with not letting disputes multiply in the Beit Midrash, sometimes there's a very, very thin line of, am I doing that for the Beit Midrash or doing that for my own ego? And I think we're meant to start questioning at this point which side of the line Rabban Gamliel is at this moment. He said to him, Yehoshua, stand up and they will testify against you. Then Rabban Gamliel sat and taught while Rabbi Yehoshua stood up on his feet. Let's just picture this for a moment so we can understand the emotional impact of what's happening here. Forcing someone to stand up in the Beit Midrash while everyone else is sitting is a humiliation tactic. It's essentially the same as, I don't think that they do this anymore. An elementary school teacher making a student go stand in the corner after they've misbehaved. It's a way of singling that student out, of saying you have done something wrong. And part of it is the feeling of being singled out. And part of it is also everyone is looking at you. Everyone is aware of your humiliation. Rabban Gamliel sat and taught while Rabbi Yehoshua stood on his feet until the whole people murmured and said to Chutzpit, the translator, stand. And he stood to stop the announcing. Let's take a moment to understand this. Here in the English, it describes Chutzpit as a translator. That's not quite correct. What they used to do, because the Beit Midrash was so large, and because the teacher's voice could not necessarily carry that far, is they would have someone who sat next to the teacher, whose job it was to repeat what the teacher said in a loud, projected voice so that everyone could hear. What's essentially happening at this moment then is essentially the same as if the entire Beit Midrash is looking at Rabbi Yehoshua standing there being humiliated, and they start to whisper and you hear the volume get louder and louder until essentially someone goes over and does what is the ancient world equivalent of snatching the microphone out of Rabban Gamliel's hands. They're not willing to let this humiliation continue. It has gone too far. They said, how long will Rabban Gamliel go on insulting Rabbi Yehoshua? Here it's going to mention a few other places where Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua have had encounters in the past. In Rosh Hashanah, he insulted him. In Bechorot, he insulted him. And here, too, he insults him. Come, let us depose him. Okay, let's pause for a moment. This is drastic. It is drastic to say, let's depose the head of the Beit Midrash. And I want us to notice a few things here. First of all, the situation has become intolerable. And the situation has become intolerable specifically in the human cost of what Rabban Gamliel is trying to do. The human cost of trying to make sure that there is no dispute requires again and again making holders of dissenting voices small. Humiliation has been the tactic that Rabban Gamliel has used. But I also want us to note the sort of thinking that goes into, okay, what is the obvious solution here? The obvious solution is deposing him. This is in many ways a Beit Midrash that has seen its leader time and time again use the tactic of the only way to solve a problem is either to expel someone from the Beit Midrash or to shut them down. And that is the tool that they then know how to use. What are we going to do with Rabban Gamliel? We'll use his own tool against him. We'll depose him. And I want us to pay attention because that already tells us, I think, a lot about what is it within the realm of imagination for this Beit Midrash. Part of what we'll see as the story goes on, I want to suggest, is the realm of imagination of what a Beit Midrash might look like expanding. We'll see how that goes. So we're going to depose him. Whom shall we appoint in his stead? Can we appoint Rabbi Yehoshua? No, since he is a party in the incident. Shall we appoint Rabbi Akiva? No, since perhaps Rabban Gamliel will, I would say, have power to punish him because he lacks ancestral merit. Let us then appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, for he is wise, he is rich, and he is of the 10th generation from Ezra. He is wise, so if someone challenges him, he can reply. And he is rich, so if it is necessary for someone to attend the palace of the emperor, he will be qualified to do so. And he is of the 10th generation from Ezra, so he possesses ancestral merit, and Rabban Gamliel will not be able to punish him. Let's pay attention here. The story, I think, is setting us up in many ways to see this new appointee, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, as what I would call a Rabban Gamliel 2.0. What does he have going for him? He's wise. Okay, that's a baseline requirement to be the head of the Beit Midrash, hopefully. But also he is rich and he is the 10th generation from Ezra. What does that remind us of? That reminds us of Rabban Gamliel. He has probably more ancestral wealth than anyone else in the Beit Midrash. And he has inherited his seat by merit of ancestral inheritance, of who he is descended from. I think in many ways, the story is setting us up to think, okay, we'll have another Rabban Gamliel. Maybe this one will be nicer. But let's pay attention, because I think Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah immediately begins to reveal himself to be quite different. They came to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and asked him, would the master consent to become the head of the Sari house? He said to them, I will first go and take counsel with the people of my house. He went and consulted his wife. Okay, let's pause for a moment. In two sentences, we've already had what I would say is an important personality reveal. I'm going to ask people to reply in the chat. He says, let's just imagine this for a moment. They come to him and they say, will you take what is the most important position that the Jewish people currently have to offer? And he first says, let me go and consult with the people of my house. And we're told, who does that mean? He goes and consults with his wife. What is the story potentially already trying to tell us about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? What is it setting up for us to understand about who this person is, who he might be, particularly who he might be in relationship to Rabban Gamliel? Okay, Sarah Brooks says, husband and wife are a team. Great. Shai Robkin says, proof that he is wise. Okay, great. Who is wise? Let's quote Pirkei Avot for a moment. Someone who learns from everyone. He wants to take advice. Modest. He considers others' feelings and thoughts. And Nancy Simmons says, equality. Okay, great. Let's just really absorb this for a moment. This is someone, first of all, who understands that he is not going to have all of the answers immediately, right? He is not going to have all of the answers immediately. It is important for him to think about what do other people who I respect in this world think about this question? And also, who is the person who he respects most in this world? It's his wife. That's very, very interesting. These stories so far have focused almost exclusively on the Beit Midrash and the relationships within the Beit Midrash. And almost for the first time, we are seeing someone who has a strong relationship outside of that, in the home, with someone whose opinion he values. This is already telling us this is a different sort of a person. And now they're going to think it through together. They're going to kind of ping pong back and forth. She said to him, perhaps they will soon depose you. Right? If they fired the CEO in one day, you don't necessarily want to jump to be the next CEO. He said, let a man use the precious cup one day and tomorrow it will be broken. What's he saying? He's saying, yeah, they might depose me, but at least I'll have had the experience. I'll have used the precious cup. There's something interesting here. This is not a person who is desperate for power. There's nothing kind of grasping about him. He knows this might pass and he's okay with that. She said to him, you have no white hair. What does that mean? She's looking at him and saying, you kind of look like a baby, right? Are they going to respect you? That day he was 18 years old, but a miracle was done to him and 18 rows of his hair turned white. That is why Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, behold, I am like 70 years old and not 70 years old. You might recognize this from the Haggadah, when a few of the rabbis, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua, and I'm sorry, I'm missing someone, are sitting in Bnei Brak at a Seder. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah describes himself as, Hare ani ki ben shivim shana, I am like a man of 70 years old. This is an intertext for that. Note, by the way, who is not present at that Seder? Rabban Gamliel is not present at that Seder, even though he is of that generation. I think it makes a lot of sense. Rabban Gamliel is a complicated and sometimes difficult person, it makes sense that he is not invited to that particular Seder. It was taught that day they removed the doorkeeper and the students were given permission to enter. Okay, really important fact that we didn't know till now. There is a guard at the door of the Beit Midrash. Let's think back to who Rabban Gamliel is. What's he concerned about? He's concerned about, I don't want dispute to sort of take over the Beit Midrash. He wants to be able to control. And the storyteller, very interestingly, brings us almost to halfway in the story before he tells us, you know how far that went? That went so far, his desperation for control to keep things from getting out of hand, that he had a guard at the door of the Beit Midrash controlling who could come in. For Rabban Gamliel used to proclaim, any student whose outside is not like his inside shall not enter the study house. There's so much to say about that line that we're not going to say for the sake of time. But inside like his outside, of course, this is a real concern. You do not want people who are hypocrites. You do not want people who are trying to present themselves as one thing while secretly being another. But, let's pay attention here. First of all, the very first thing we see in this story is that the atmosphere that Rabban Gamliel has created in the Beit Midrash is actually forcing that, right? What's the first thing he does? He essentially forces Rabbi Yoshua to lie to him about what his real opinion is. He is the one, through his desire for control, forcing people to present as otherwise than they are. And second, I think the storyteller has already shown us their hand just a few lines before. What did we just see? We just saw someone whose outside was transformed to not really be representative of who they are on the inside. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, through a miracle, being given white hair so that he will look old enough to have the job that he has. I think the storyteller is tilting their hand and saying, I don't know that this total sort of resemblance between inside and outside that Rabban Gamliel is demanding is either realistic or what we should really want. Let's keep going. We're going to keep examining that theme. On that day, a number of benches were added. Rabbi Yochanan said, the matter is disputed by Abba Yosef ben Dostai and the rabbis. One holds that 400 benches were added and one 700. These are just meant to be massive amounts of numbers, massive numbers that show you how many people wanted to be in the Beit Midrash who were kept out. Rabban Gamliel was greatly disturbed and said, perhaps, God forbid, I have withheld Torah from Israel. Let's just pay attention here. The storyteller is unwilling to paint Rabban Gamliel as any one thing. Rabban Gamliel is not a villain here. He wants in his heart of hearts what is best for the Jewish people. He's worried that his control has kept Torah from proliferating among the Jewish people. In a dream, he was shown white casks filled with ashes, meaning people whose outsides are not like their insides. But that was not the case. He was shown that just to calm his mind. Again, so much to say about this line that we're not going to do for the sake of time. It was taught Eduyot was under review that day. And wherever it says on that day, it references that day. Meaning that day, an entire Masechet was written just with the influx of people and the Torah that they brought into the Beit Midrash when the guard wasn't there. And any time in the stories of the Gemara, you see the words on that day, this was taught. This is the day that we were talking about, the day that the guard was removed from the Beit Midrash. On that day, Yehuda, an Ammonite proselyte, an Ammonite convert, came before them in the study house. He said, am I permitted to enter the congregation? Okay, let's pay attention to this. This is really important. Ammon and Moab are two nations where even if someone converts, they're forbidden from marrying a born Jew for several generations. Here we have Yehuda, an Ammonite convert who comes and says, can I enter the congregation? Which is a way of saying, can I marry someone who was born a Jew? Rabban Gamliel said to him, you are forbidden to enter the congregation. Right? Rabban Gamliel saying, it says straight out in the Torah, I'm sorry, you can't. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, you are permitted to enter the congregation. Rabban Gamliel said to Rabbi Yeshua, but has it not already been said, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the congregation of the Lord? Right? I have a verse in the Torah that tells me no. What are you saying yes for? And here Rabbi Yeshua gives a really important answer. Rabbi Yeshua said to him, and are Ammon and Moab still dwelling in their places? Sennacherib, king of Assyria, has already gone and mixed up all the nations, as it is said, and I have removed the boundaries of people and have plundered their treasures, and I have brought down their inhabitants as a mighty one. And anything that is separated from the majority. Let's pay attention to this. The Assyrians, who are responsible for the expulsion of the 10 northern tribes. If you've heard of the 10 lost tribes, there's a reason that they were lost, and that's that the Assyrians had a particular sort of empire-building strategy, and that was a strategy of population transfer. In order to make it more difficult for places that they conquered to rebel, when they conquered an area, they would take the population of that area and distribute them to lots of different places. They did that so that there would be sort of no native ethnic majority in any one place that could foment rebellion against the empire. That also meant that people generally lost their identities. That's why the 10 lost tribes are lost. It's because they assimilated into the many, many places where they were brought, presumably, and no longer have any idea who they are. Why is that important for this? Rabbi Yeshua is looking at him and saying, Ammon and Moab aren't who they were in the time of the Torah. Great, so he's from Ammon. That doesn't mean anything. The Assyrians have already come. They have mixed up all the populations. We have no reason to think that this person is actually a descendant of the original Ammonites. Now, I want us to pay attention here because it's a technical point. But it's a technical point that I think is playing into one of the major themes of the story, and that is, are people and things what they appear to be? Rabbi Yeshua is looking and saying, you're looking at this person and saying, well, he's from Ammon, so he must be an Ammonite. And I'm looking at you and saying, the world is much more complicated than that. People are different people from different places. You want the outside to look exactly like the inside. You want to be able to have a label on this person that says Ammonite, and then you know exactly what to do with them. That's not how the world works. The world is complicated. The world brings a multitude of factors to the table. Of course, the world is going to, you might say, have multiplicity of practice. Of course, the world is going to demand multiple opinions because the world itself, the problems, the questions that it presents are not going to be straightforward. They are not going to simply be one thing all the way through. Rabban Gamliel said to him, but it already has been said, and I afterward will return to the captivity of the children of Ammon, says the Lord. He's saying, okay, but I have a prophecy. I have a prophecy that says that God will bring Ammon back to its dwelling place. And what does Rabbi Yeshua say to him? Rabbi Yeshua said to him, it also already has been said, I shall return the captivity of my people Israel. And they have not yet returned. Rabbi Yeshua is saying, very nice that you have a prophecy about Ammon being brought back and everything being put back into their nice little containers. You know what else we have a prophecy about? We have a prophecy that we, the Jewish people, will be restored. And guess what? We haven't been yet. You, Rabban Gamliel, can aspire to this messianic moment where everything is back where it should be and everything is in its container and you can label things and people clearly. But look around. That is not the moment that we are living in. Can you look at the world, tell the truth about what it is, and allow that truth then to influence what you do in the Beit Midrash? Can you create a Beit Midrash that both reflects and tells the truth about the world outside of it? Rabban Gamliel said, since this is the situation, I will go and appease Rabbi Yoshua. Rabban Gamliel, it seems, has learned something from this exchange. Rabban Gamliel has maybe learned something about the world being more complicated. He has maybe learned something, at the very least, about Rabbi Yoshua's voice is important for the Beit Midrash. And in a real moment of growth, I think, he is going and he's going to try to apologize to Rabbi Yoshua. When he reached the house, he saw that the walls of his house were black. He said to Rabbi Yoshua in wonderment, from the walls of your house, it is apparent that you are a blacksmith. Let's just pay attention for this moment. These are two men that we can imagine have sat in the same Beit Midrash for decades. And A, we realize this is the first time Rabban Gamliel has seen Rabbi Yoshua's house. But B, we realize this is the first time Rabban Gamliel has thought, oh, what does Rabbi Yoshua do for a living? That's really important because I think a big part of this is also curiosity. Does Rabban Gamliel have curiosity about the people around him? Does he have curiosity about what the world really is about? Is an Ammonite really an Ammonite? What does the world outside of the Beit Midrash look like? And we realize he hasn't even had that curiosity about the people who sit right next to him in the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Yoshua said to him, woe unto a generation that you are its leader, as you are unaware of the difficulties of Torah scholars, how they make a living and how they feed themselves. Rabbi Yoshua is looking at him and saying, what did you think the rest of us were doing to manage to make a living? I know that that's a question you never had to think about for yourself, but you're a leader. You need to be thinking about how is everyone else faring? How do they make a living? How are they actually as people and not just voices in a Beit Midrash? He said to him, I insulted you, forgive me. He paid him no attention. He said, do it in deference to my father, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who was one of the leaders of Israel at the time of the destruction of the temple. He was appeased. Rabban Gamliel is doing something really interesting by evoking his father here. Two things to know. First is, I think it's a sign of humility in some ways. Rabban Gamliel is saying, look, I know that I don't have the merit right now for you to forgive me, but we have a long history. My father served the Jewish people in his memory. Can you forgive me? But it's also important to note that Rabban Gamliel's father was martyred by the Romans, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. That's important, I think, because, of course, in terms of forgive me, he's saying, can you forgive me in merit of my father who gave his life for the Jewish people? But I think on a deeper level, it might also be a little bit of an allusion to, can you see why I am so worried? Can you see why I'm so worried about dispute, about arguments? What happened to my personal family because of all these disputes within the Jewish people? Yes, we all lost the temple, but I lost my father. Of course, I'm trying so hard to keep control. Can you understand where I'm coming from? And at that moment, Rabbi Yoshua forgives him. They said, who will go and inform the sages that Rabban Gamliel apologized? The launderer said to him, I will go. Rabbi Yoshua sends word to the study hall. The one who wears the uniform will continue to wear the uniform. The one who did not wear the uniform will not say to the one who wears the uniform, remove your uniform and I will wear it. I.e., let him keep doing his job. He's had this job for a long time. He inherited his job. Give him back his position. Rabbi Akiva said to the sages, lock the gate so that Rabban Gamliel's servants will not come and disturb the sages. Okay, again, we have a question here of, is this Beit Midrash really changing with Rabban Gamliel's absence? And here again, we're getting a sort of voice of, but they're still using Rabban Gamliel's methods, even if they're using them against Rabban Gamliel. What's Rabbi Akiva's instinct? Rabbi Akiva's instinct is keep him from getting in, put the guard back at the door of the Beit Midrash. not enough has done. We haven't had enough movement. We're still thinking in terms of who can the guard keep out. We're going to skip line 17. This is an elaborate sort of explanation by Rabbi Yoshua of he should be allowed to keep his job because he has inherited it. Rabbi Akiva said to him, Rabbi Yoshua, have you been appeased? Everything we did was for your honor. Early tomorrow, you and I will go to his doorway. There's something I think very sweet here. Rabbi Akiva is looking at Rabbi Yoshua and saying, ultimately, we did this because we care about you and because we love you. It's a real moment amidst all of this ideology that I think is trying to point towards, okay, but where does change come from? Change doesn't necessarily come from your ideology. It comes from people actually really caring about each other. That's what drives this. Now we're faced with a problem. And that problem is, but we hired a new CEO, right? What are we going to do with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? They said, what shall we do? Remove him, meaning Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We learned one elevates to a higher level of sanctity and does not downgrade. You can't just fire the new head of the Beit Midrash. Let one sage lecture 1 week and the other sage 1 week. They will come to be jealous. You can't have two co-CEOs, they're saying, in exact even positions of power. Rather, Rabbi Gamliel will lecture 3 weeks and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah 1 week. We're going to have this system of 3 weeks out of the month, Rabbi Gamliel will give that lecture as the head of the Beit Midrash. But 1 week out of the month, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah will. I want us to pay really close attention here. I think this ending of the story is often understood as a sort of technical wrap-up. We're trying to take care of the dangling strings. I think it's much more than that. I think this is an end of the story that's saying, yes, Rabbi Gamliel is back, but things are different. And things are different, not just in that, okay, someone else has some power now, but in that the structure of the Beit Midrash is fundamentally different now. And why? Because there are going to be multiple voices. If there are multiple voices, even if it is 3-1, even if Rabbi Gamliel is 3 weeks out of four, we actually cannot go back to a position of, well, the main thing is that there can be no dispute. This is a system that actually is about there must inherently be multiplicity of voices. The Beit Midrash now, I think, has changed. Now, I think, is moving past the systems that Rabbi Gamliel used to use. That is the explanation for the following exchange. Whose week was it? It was the week of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. When they ask in different texts, oh, whose week was it that week? It was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's week. That's why. It's because we have this new system. I want us to take our last 5 minutes to take a look at one of the texts that references that line, whose week was it? It was the week of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We're now looking at source 4. This is Chagiga 3a. And I want us to take a look at it because I think that this new sort of system comes through not only in Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's presence, but in his teachings. Let's take a look. There was an incident involving Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma when they went to greet Rabbi Yoshua in Piki'in. Rabbi Yoshua said to them, what novel idea was taught today in the study hall? They said to him, we are your students and we drink from your water. You're the only one who teaches us anything. He says to them, even so, there cannot be a study hall without a novelty. Okay. Theme one from this parallel text, a Beit Midrash requires innovation. That is the definition of a Beit Midrash. You don't ignore innovation out of deference from your teacher. If your teacher is doing the right thing, they should be demanding innovation, new thoughts, new opinions. He asked them, whose week was it? They said to him, it was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's week. He inquired, and on what subject was the lecture today? They said to him, he spoke about the portion of the mitzvah of assembly. This is the mitzvah of hakel, when the entire Jewish people gathers together every so often to hear the king read the Torah. Let's pay attention here. The entire Jewish people gathering together to hear the Torah. That's what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is speaking about. This is fundamentally speaking about the Torah belongs to all Jews, i.e., we don't want the guard at the door. Rabbi Yeshua persisted. And what verse did he interpret? They said to him that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah interpreted the following verse. Assemble the people, the men, the women, and the little ones. If the men come to learn and women come to hear, what do the little ones come? They come in order for God to give a reward to those who bring them. Everyone, it matters for everyone to be there, regardless of what their contribution is going to be. Let's skip ahead to more of what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah taught that day. Well fastened, just as this plant flourishes and multiplies, so too do matters of Torah flourish and multiply. Those that are composed in collections. These are Torah scholars who sit in many groups and engage in Torah study. There are often debates among these groups. Debates among these groups. As some sages render an object or person impure, and these render it pure. These prohibit an action, and these permit it. These deem an item invalid, and those deem it valid. If a person says, now how can I study Torah when it contains so many different opinions, right? The danger of multiplicity of opinion. The verse states they have all been given from one shepherd. God gave them, one leader said them from the mouth of the master of all creation. So too you make your ears like a funnel and inquire for yourself an understanding heart to hear both the statements of those who render objects impure and the statements of those who render them pure. The statements of those who prohibit and the statements of those who permit. The statements of those who deem items invalid and the statements of those who deem them valid. Let's pay attention here. We've been working so hard over the course of these stories to ask what should the structure of the Beit Midrash be to allow this new world of Torah to flourish. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is looking, I think, at the end of all these stories and saying, stop asking what the Beit Midrash needs to be and start asking who you need to be. Who do you need to be as a learner of Torah? You need to be someone who can hear many opinions. You need to be someone whose heart has room for them all. You need to be someone who wants to sit with other people and learn and can take it all in. And I want to add, not be afraid. When Rabbi Yeshua heard these interpretations, he said to them in these words, no generation is considered orphaned if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah dwells among it. We're going to wrap up here. I want to suggest and offer that at the end of these stories, Rabbi Yeshua is pointing us to the possibility that we've finally encountered the leader that we need. And that's the leader who says, stop looking at me and start looking at each other. Start being able to hear each other. Start being able to have room in your hearts for one another. And Rabbi Yeshua, I think, looks and says, if that's the sort of leadership that we have, I'll paraphrase him. I think he might be saying, for the first time, I really trust that Torah will be all right. Thank you all for the privilege of learning with you over the last month or two. It's been a real privilege. Thank you all. Bye.